And good morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is State versus William T. Kelly. I should note for the record that Justice Frydenberg is recused from all of today's cases. So with that, we will proceed. And Mr. Norlinger, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice.
Good morning, members of the court. This is the case of State versus William Kelly. It is a rather peculiar set of facts that I will recite to the court at this point. Mr. Kelly is currently charged with first-degree sexual assault of an individual with the initials TK and date of birth March 5th, 1993. At the time that Mr. Kelly was charged with this, he had been recently discharged from the Department of Corrections for two other cases from Gage County. CRs 0867 and 0879. In 0879, Mr. Kelly was charged with two counts of child abuse, intentional child abuse, that he pled to. In the other case, 0867, he was charged and pled to possession by a prohibited person and false handgun permit application. He was represented by Todd Lancaster from the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy on both of those matters. The issue in this case revolves around what the exact plea agreement was in those matters in 08 and whether it has any bearing on the first-degree sexual assault that he is charged with in this case. The written plea agreement that was put into the record both in 0867 and 0879 does not include a prohibition against prosecuting Mr. Kelly for the first-degree sexual assault of TK that he's currently charged with.
I understand your argument is that there's been a breach of the plea agreement.
Correct.
But to get to that, doesn't this have to be a double jeopardy violation?
In terms of filing it as a plea and bar?
Right. I mean, we only, as I understand your argument for why we have jurisdiction at this point, it's that you filed a plea and bar and the plea and bar was denied. But I don't see much argument as to why filing the second set of charges constitutes a double jeopardy problem.
Well, I appreciate the justice's standpoint with regard to that. I will tell you that I found it difficult to figure out what to do with these facts when I was appointed to it. I thought that after consulting with other members of my firm that it was appropriate to file it in this manner to try to forestall the prosecution if there was, in fact, a plea agreement with regard to it. And I raised it in a double jeopardy argument because of the constitutional issues, I think mostly surrounding the second assignment of error, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim with regard to Mr. Lancaster. As the court is aware from my brief and the facts of this case, the written plea agreement did not include any prohibition against prosecution for this matter. However, Mr. Lancaster has contemporaneous notes and memos to his file to indicate that that was in fact part of the agreement in the matter.
But what's the double jeopardy? I mean, he hasn't been previously punished, correct, for an assault against TK.
That's true.
He hasn't been previously placed in jeopardy even for that, right? Because there were no charges filed before.
Well, that's true.
Help me find some double jeopardy.
Well, I would say that there was an agreement to forego charges when he entered pleas to other matters, and that part of that attached, well, the argument is essentially that he has entered pleas to other cases. His understanding of that agreement was to prohibit the state from proceeding with regard to this case. When you enter a plea, jeopardy attaches with regard to those charges, and that is the theory under which we proceed, that this agreement is part of a overarching set of facts where Mr. Kelly did enter a plea, he was sentenced, and he was committed to the Department of Corrections, and therefore the state should be barred from going forward under that double jeopardy argument.
Setting aside for the moment your ineffective assistance of counsel allegation, how do you deal with our precedent regarding plea agreements, and particularly State versus Landera?
Now, I think that's why, unfortunately, the ineffective assistance claim is the much stronger one, because, the written plea agreement simply does not include this case.
So how do we get to jurisdiction if we don't have a double jeopardy and we don't have even a violation of the plea agreement?
Well, I would disagree that there isn't a violation of the plea agreement, but I understand the court's question. Again, I understand that jeopardy is an issue that the court will have to determine on this interlocutory appeal, which it's been reached first. And again, as I stated to Justice Papik, the argument, or at least the theory that I'm functioning under, is that jeopardy applied because it was part of a total plea agreement where there was a plea and there was a sentence imposed with regard to the matter.
You made reference to the overarching facts, which I assume you meant included this case and the case that he pled to. What in our record tells us about the relationship of this case to the facts in the case that he pled to?
Well, I think that's mostly tied to both the testimony of the appellant, Mr. Kelly, at the plea and bar, and Mr. Lancaster's testimony, along with the documentation that was submitted and offered as part of the plea and bar proceeding. Most importantly, with regard to Mr. Lancaster's testimony, he's able to recall specifically that there was ongoing plea negotiations with counsel for the state, Mr. Rittenour, that he presented an offer while Mr. Kelly was incarcerated at the Diagnostic and Evaluation Center. He was held there as a safekeep. Mr. Kelly rejected that offer. He then called Mr. Rittenour, counsel for the state, the Gage County attorney at the time. A new agreement was reached that is handwritten and then memorialized in memos with regard to this matter. Now, again, I concede that Mr. Lancaster did not include those facts as part of the written plea agreement in this matter. However, it does appear clear that Mr. Lancaster is being honest and forthright with regard to why that occurred and explains that in the record before the district court that came up on this appeal. And you also have Mr. Kelly's testimony at the plea and bar proceeding indicating specifically, I would not have entered this plea if my understanding was that the state was forestalled from going forward with the sexual assault of TK that is the underlying charge in this new matter.
So if we were to pursue your theory to its ultimate end, what would be the disposition of the prior case?
Well,
do we go back to square one and he's subject to being prosecuted again as if he had never been?
Well, that would be one of the two ways to go on with regard to the case. Yeah, I would suggest, and it's in my brief with regard to the Commonwealth versus Fruhan from the state of Pennsylvania that's quoted by State versus Thompson, that the appropriate way to deal with the matter would be is to enforce the agreement that Mr. Kelly believed was in place at the time that he entered the plea and forestall the state from being able to proceed on this new charge.
To enforce the agreement that the state never actually made.
Well, there's a factual dispute with regard to whether that is the case. I think that Mr. Rittenour, counsel for the state, testified that that wasn't part of the plea agreement. However, that's in direct contradiction to what Lancaster and the appellant testified to. And Lancaster, at least, as opposed to Mr. Rittenour, has pretty extensive notes and documentation to substantiate the claim that that was part of a plea agreement that he was ineffective for placing into the record.
How do we get to the result that you are seeking without undoing what we said in State versus Landera?
I appreciate what the court's saying. I believe that that is the problem that we have to, that this court has to figure out how to deal with in this case. But that is,
that you are where you are.
Correct. I was handed these set of facts, and I'm trying to figure out how to properly bring the issue before the court to have them address
it. If this court were to find there's no jurisdiction, then how do you see the path?
Well, then at that point, I think if there's no jurisdiction, I file some type of motion for specific performance and address the issue in another way, which in fact I considered as part of when I was handed this case. I just, again, in overabundance of caution, tried to think of a way to raise the issue as a plea and bar to not have be told later that I had waived that appeal if in this issue later on, and I'll reserve my...
Do you acknowledge that double jeopardy is the only basis for the motion that you filed? That's the only constitutional problem you're asserting?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the statute's clear and the case law is clear that a double jeopardy issue has to be in play in order for this court to reach the issue on a plea.
So your motion, you don't read to assert a claim for specific performance of the plea agreement or the due process required. It's just double jeopardy.
It's double jeopardy. And I believe, depending on what happens with this case, there can be a motion for specific performance, but I did not raise that issue in order to proceed first on a plea and bar, which has to be filed at specific times pursuant to this court's case law and statute.
Thank you.
I'll reserve my 15 seconds.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent, and I represent the appellee of the state of Nebraska. The preliminary issue in this case is whether this court has jurisdiction to hear this appeal. We submit the answer is no. There is no double jeopardy issue in this case. Consequently, the district court's order denying what Kelly simply termed a plea and bar does not provide a basis for this court's jurisdiction, because the real complaint in this case is that the state breached the plea agreement. The issue here is whether the court's order denying that claim is a final order in its own right, or more specifically, whether it's an order affecting a substantial right made in a special proceeding. Again, we submit the answer is no for two reasons. First, the order was not made in a special proceeding, as that term has been defined, since there is no statutory remedy for breach of a plea agreement. And second, the order does not affect a substantial right, or since the right can be effectively vindicated on appeal from a final judgment. And this is so because non-prosecution agreement, unlike double jeopardy or the right to a speedy trial, do not confer upon the defendant a right not to be tried, but rather a right not to be convicted and punished, which again can be vindicated on appeal from a final judgment.
What's your authority for asserting that a non-prosecution agreement only confers a right not to be punished?
Federal case law. Basically, the Lewis case that I cited in my brief, the Eighth Circuit cited another case that they had decided, United States v. Bailey, I believe it was from 1994, but they also cited a case from the Second Circuit, and in that case, the Ecker case, they cited some additional authority, but that's basically the line that they have drawn.
Is that in tension with the term? I mean, non-prosecution agreement is, we're not going to prosecute, right?
Right, so, but that is the line that has been drawn, and in fact,
is that a cogent line?
Well, yes, if you look at the reason, the reason why we don't allow all of these appeals in criminal cases is because if you look at the various things that can go wrong in a case, a motion to suppress gets denied, for example, or you have a constitutional speedy trial claim, or perhaps you have a selective prosecution claim like we had not too long ago. If you can appeal from all of those because they potentially affect or dispositive or potentially affect the outcome of the case, then you've got all of this piecemeal litigation and all of this chaos going on in these cases. And so they have restricted, at least the Supreme Court has, the U.S. Supreme Court, and this court has as well, to very few instances where you can actually appeal. And the courts have drawn the distinction between a right not to be tried versus a right whose remedy requires dismissal. And this court, actually, in Dugan v. State, which is a habeas case from a couple of years ago, I think it was 2017, actually recognized that same right. However, assuming the court has jurisdiction, we submit that Kelly's breach of contract claim is without merit. In his brief, he relies heavily on the Court of Appeals decision in Thompson. However, the issue presented in Thompson is not the same issue presented here. Thompson involved an implied promise, whereas here, Kelly claims that there was an express promise that was inadvertently omitted from the written plea agreement and seeks to introduce parole evidence to supplement the terms of that agreement. While this appears to be an issue of first impression in this jurisdiction, it has been addressed on multiple occasions by several federal courts. Generally speaking, those courts have found that whereas here the parties enter or execute a fully integrated plea agreement, the defendant may not offer parole evidence to modify or supplement the terms of that agreement. And that is essentially the approach that was taken by the district court in this case, and we submit that was correct.
In the federal cases, let me start the question this way, because I'm not that familiar these days with the federal deals, but they tend to be lengthy and specific, whereas the state deals tend not to be. Is that relevant to what case law has developed on the federal side?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think at least at the state level, it's rare for us to even have a written plea agreement as we do here, let alone one that has an integration clause. And so, no, I don't think that, the terms are the terms. And I just think you look at what was actually agreed upon in the agreement. But, at the federal level, most of them are written, which is why there's a lot more case law on breaches and that sort of thing than we have here.
You just made reference to the fact that we rarely see written plea agreements with county attorneys and on the state level.
Yes.
Is there anything in our record that tells us why there was a written plea agreement in this case? Why
Well, I believe the reason there was a written plea agreement in this case is because Mr. Kelly is a suspect in his wife's disappearance. And I believe that there's a suspicion, of course, that she is deceased. They have not found her body, and they wanted to make absolute certain that they were laying out the terms in this agreement to make clear that they were not giving up that investigation there and that they were resolving only the charges that were at issue here, the gun charges and the drug charges in the one case, and then the sexual assaults, which he eventually pled to child abuse. But I think that was really the justification there, was because of the ongoing homicide investigation.
If we assume, I realize you disagree with none of, or you agree with none of this, but if we assume the merits that there has been a violation of the plea agreement in this case and everything else is the same, if double jeopardy is not the constitutional problem and if a plea and bar is not the way to raise it, do you have a view on what constitutional or other provision of law, if any, requires the state to honor the plea agreement, and what's the correct mechanism to raise it?
Well, it's grounded in due process. I think that's the law is pretty clear on that, is that plea agreements, while they are a lot like contracts, they also have a constitutional dimension to them that you don't necessarily see in a commercial contract context. So when the state doesn't honor its part of the bargain, then that implicates due process because it goes to the voluntariness of the defendant's plea. It's not voluntary and intelligent if he was induced to enter a plea and give up all these constitutional rights and then the state doesn't fulfill its promise. So I think it's probably grounded in due process. That would be the constitutional hook on that claim, but I still think you have to wait until the end of the case to raise it. I don't think there's any way to do it unless the court were to find that this is a final order. I don't think there's any other way to get to it.
It can't be appealed until the end of the case, but could it be raised pretrial? Plea and abatement, something like that?
Well, I suppose. I mean, I don't know exactly what the mechanism here would be. I know it's not a plea and bar. I don't know if you file a motion to dismiss or, you know, a motion for specific performance. I think that was destined to fail, though, because obviously the written agreement doesn't contain that provision in it. And so that gets you back into the parole evidence. You have to admit this additional testimony to alter the terms of a fully integrated plea agreement, and I think that's problematic. And the federal courts have found that it is. So that's my position.
I think the question really goes to how to preserve this question for a defendant, how to preserve this question if plea and bar isn't the answer.
Well, I mean, probably, yeah. I mean,
whether
you have to file a pretrial motion.
Whether there is a deal that would have prohibited this trial.
Well, I think if he had filed the motion, at least made the objection pretrial, regardless of where you called it, and then he had renewed that objection at the time of trial, assuming he doesn't enter a plea, because obviously if he enters a plea, he's waived his right to challenge. He's waived his defense based on this. But I would imagine you would renew it just like anything else, like a motion to suppress, something of that nature, so that you at least preserve the issue for appeal.
And that would distinguish this, because the plea and bar is essentially so you don't have to go through another trial.
Exactly.
That is not an issue.
No.
Therefore, go through the trial, preserve it, and then take it up. Is that
right? Right, and that's
in some manner.
Yes, okay. Yes, and that's exactly why, you know, this court has said with double jeopardy and with the right to a speedy trial that the right that's being protected there is the right not to be tried. Period. It's the trial itself that's the affront, but that's not necessarily the case when you're dealing with a breach of a plea agreement, because again, that can be vindicated at the end. It's really no different than challenging the validity of your conviction on some other ground. But as for Kelly's ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the record contains no indication that this issue was presented to the district court. It was not alleged in his plea and bar. It was not mentioned at the hearing. It was not addressed by the district court in its order. And consequently, that issue is not before you. However, assuming that without conceding that Kelly could assert Lancaster's ineffective assistance as a defense to the charges in this case, it is without merit. As explained in the brief, Lancaster's testimony was contradicted by his own case notes, which were created at the time these events occurred. Furthermore, Kelly bears some responsibility for the alleged omission. If, as he testified, the state's promise not to prosecute him was the only reason that he entered into this agreement, then he should have caught it, and he had two opportunities to correct it. First, at the time he signed the agreement, and again at the plea hearing when he was questioned by the district court. And the only rational explanation for, he failed to do so, and the only rational explanation for these various failures is that they aren't really failures at all. The state simply did not agree not to prosecute him for the instant offenses. And that's all I have. So unless the court has questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, 13 seconds.
13 seconds, Mr. Norlinger.
I'll be brief. I believe I argued the ineffective assistance claim to the district court. It was part of my original brief, which the Attorney General was the prosecution for that. I cannot answer why the court did not address that issue, but it was argued, and it is properly preserved for this court to look at, should they deem it to have jurisdiction. And I'll submit it on that, and I thank the justices for their time.
Thank you very much. Were you appointed in this matter, Mr. Norlinger?
I was, Judge.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
The next case of the day, then, is Huff versus Brown.